And we're back and we're talking horror movies. What makes them work? What makes them last beyond an initial showing? And there being a movie number 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. We're going to ask that of David Allensworth. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Peter.
What makes a horror movie a franchise?
First of all, thank you for having me on the show today.
My pleasure.
I think it makes a franchise when the people, the fans, want more. It's always evident by the box office or people talking online that they love this idea and there's more to tell. Or sometimes it's built on a single character, usually the bad guy. You're looking at Nightmare, you're looking at Freddy, you're looking at Jason, you're looking at Michael, for Friday the 13th, Halloween. And that's what makes a franchise usually is based on that evil character that can kind of thread it through. Not always the case, but that's what will indicate a franchise.
All right, let's say I'm a movie maker and I'm making a horror movie. Can I anticipate, is there a formula almost for making a horror movie that's going to turn into a franchise?
No, you can't. You have to make a choice. One where I just mentioned where you pick a singular kind of character that you can like hang your hat on. Or you can create a universe and that seems to be the kind of the going route today. The franchises of the past, the ones that I just mentioned, even Saw, they are built on that singular idea. Nowadays, like The Conjuring universe, or now with Jordan Peele, it looks like he's creating a universe as well. Even M. Night Shyamalan, that's how you say his name, is creating a universe too. So it's a universe kind of taking the Marvel Comics approach where you're kind of have offshoots and spinoffs that will help fill that area. So if you're a new filmmaker, that's what I would do. And that's what I am doing with this film that I have coming up, which is called Soul to Keep.
Okay, and we'll talk about that in just a bit.
Yeah.
But perhaps the most famous horror franchise is Dracula. What made it work?
I guess we're talking about Universal's Dracula. We're not talking about other, Bram Stoker's. That doesn't really count for the count. Dracula, because it's one of the original four from Universal, had a certain kind of romanticism on screen that you saw this incredible character kind of wooing us while wooing his victims. And that was quite scary for an audience that was more than, 70 years ago to see this kind of thing up on the screen. So, that kind of worked for that audience. Same with Frankenstein was even more so, I felt. Even the Wolfman or the Mummy. Like, all those characters had a kind of an original scary tone to them, but they didn't, there was no such thing as a slasher film yet. It was just more of the nuance of how they lived on the screen.
You've talked, though, about characters that have a human persona in some way. There are horror movies that have monsters, too. What about them?
Even if they're monsters, they still have human qualities. That's the thing. We personify in whatever character that we build as writers and filmmakers. We'll take a monster, and that monster has qualities that are in us or that we don't want to have in us. And that's what scares us. For instance, demons. In demonology, they prey on our senses, on the things that on the gluttony of life. And those characters, they're monsters, but we give them human qualities jealousy and rage. And those are things that come out of us humans. So we need to personify those bad things on screen into a monster or any evil character so that we can kind of separate those things from ourselves. It's kind of a catharsis.
Okay. Tell me about your movie.
My movie is called Soul to Keep, and we have a movie monster, too. His name is Beelzebub, and that's a well-known, you know, demon, prince of hell, who preys on a bunch of millennials who party up at a, you know, country house and in the middle of winter. And as they party, they go to the basement, and they discover a ritual room that shouldn't really be there, and they go for it, and they go for a possession spell. They don't think it works, but it does. Somebody gets possessed, and all hell breaks loose. One thing that's really original in this ensemble cast is that we have a deaf character who actually is played by deaf actress Sandra May Frank, and who was on Broadway in Spring Awakening. And so in that kind of dynamic, we're showcasing this really unique world of friends who all signed, or hearing friends who signed with their deaf friend. And you see that on screen. Everybody authentically is signing, and we have this deaf actress who's fantastic. And among them is someone who's possessed, and the unique element of this, as opposed to just, you know, a slasher film, is that it kind of takes a real tone, that what happens when one of your friends acts crazy and starts to do, you know, unimaginable things to your friends. Do you, you know, tie them up and try to kill them? Or do you try to, you know, get out of there? What, you know, what do you do? And I kind of present that element in this film, and it sets up as a nice horror thriller. And then we have some twists that I can't even tell you about because that would, you know, certainly spoil it.
What was your inspiration, though, for the movie?
Well, the original script was a comedy horror, not a horror, written by Eric Bram, who, you know, had a lot of that slasher, really great fun in it. And then I said, you know what, this is a great single location. I love the ensemble cast, and I love this twist. Let's make this a horror, you know, a real knock-em-dead horror film. And, the inspiration for the deaf character, for instance, is Eric's wife is mostly deaf, and so was one of my producers, and that kind of pointed to, like, well, that's an original character, and we can certainly stir up a lot of scares with somebody deaf on screen. And so I love that kind of, I love telling a story where you think it's one way, and then it twists into something else, and you realize, wait a minute, I had no idea, I didn't see that coming, I want to see this again. And I saw that in this film, and I just grabbed onto that and inspired everybody to, work with me. So great talent that I work with.
Was it hard to get it made?
Certainly. It's always hard. You know, you've got to find the money. We didn't have much money going in, and we still don't, and we're always scraping for that. That's always hard. But it certainly was a lot of fun, and it still is. We're on our publicity tour. We're opening April 2nd. We're really excited about it. When you're on set, it's exhilarating to see it come to life. So even though it's hard to do, you keep focus. You persist. You show your passion and your vision. And whether it's hard or not, it's a lot of fun.
But it's such a gamble. It's either going to be an amazing success and rival The Exorcist, or it's going to go straight to cable.
Sort of. Today's environment, you might be aware, is not just, you know, a theatrical release. You're looking at, when you say straight to cable, there's also digital, which is iTunes and Google Play, and Netflix and Amazon Prime, Hulu. These places are rather huge. They actually have a much bigger audience than most people expected. That easily rivals what people do when they go to the theater. So when we say, you know, is it going to be an Exorcist or go straight to cable? It's usually somewhere in between. And also, I picked a film that wouldn't cost a lot. So you say there's a gamble. That's true. But when you pick something that is, in terms of movies, it's not going to cost you millions of dollars, then it's less of a risk for the investors because you're only spending, you know, a quarter of a million or half a million or, you know, under a million on the project. And you could see that return just by selling it to, iTunes, Netflix, all the places I mentioned. And then there's cable. And then there's international, right? Selling it to Germany and Japan and wherever else would like to see a horror film.
Okay. It's hard for me, though, to fathom why we like to be scared so badly, because we love it.
Yeah, it's a psychology of that. I studied it in college at UCLA, and I mentioned the word earlier, actually. It's called, you know, it's catharsis. Why do we want to be scared so badly? Why do we go on a roller coaster? We want to be scared. We want to have that sensation in a safe environment. That horror is happening on the screen, not in our lives. Not, you know, what we hope. It's not happening in our lives. We like to separate and say, thank goodness that's not me. And that's why we love horror so much. And some people just love it to, like, they love the blood and the guts, and they just want to see bodies get, you know, tortured, and that's great. And then there's others that like to be scared through the story, through the bump in the night, you know, the demons and the ghosts, those kinds of stories too. But we're all, in the end, we love to feel that feeling just for a little bit and say, wow, that was really scary. But hey, look at my life. It's not like that. So I get to go out and have dinner and have a normal life. Wow, that feels really good. See how that works?
How much, though, when you're making a movie like yours, do you have to have blood and guts and dismemberment and all kinds of craziness for it to sell?
It's a really good question. As I just mentioned, this really is two kind of directions to go in, the blood and guts. You know, to show me all this on screen. And then there's the storytelling side. You don't have to go blood and guts. We have a little bit in our film on the blood and guts that kind of gives you a taste of it. But really more ours is on the story side where we're engrossing you in the concept of possession and what happens to someone and what is the goal of this horrible demon ultimately to get here onto Earth to wreak more havoc. So, you know, I like telling that kind of story because then that opens it up, right, to a universe. If you just want to go for the blood and guts, you can repeat that, but it will always be the same. And you'll see that in all those horror franchises that we talked about, that there's a diminishing return, right, when you replicate. You know, there's a few that are good along the way, like in Halloween. Halloween 3 is really good, but, you know, 4, I don't know. And in Friday the 13th, there was a few of them that were really good, and then not so much down the road. So that's a problem because you keep doing the same thing over and over again. Final Destination, perfect example of that. Bunch of kids should have died somewhere. They cheated death. So now death is going to try to reel it back in these horrific, crazy death sequences, which is what people go to see, and that's fine. But there's nothing new each time. You just set it up and you just let it go. So, you know, that's how some franchises work.
I remember there was a whole subgenre, if you will, of horror movies. Mm-hmm. Nubile young things, male and female, doing premarital sex things, getting dismembered. And the sub-message was, you know, well, maybe if they hadn't been doing what they shouldn't have been doing, they'd still be alive.
Yeah.
What do you think of those? I mean, I'm thinking of things like Friday the 13th.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that prototype was very smart to subliminally say, hey, you do those things, you die. And it was really called out on in the 90s to like inject into the horror genre because it was getting stale in Scream. If you recall, they just call it out, say, you can't do those things. You're going to die if you are the one who's going to have sex. So don't do that. And then, of course, they do it anyway, and they die. So, like, it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it's true. It's a wonderful kind of setup to say that if you are a bad person or, yeah, you have premarital sex, you do things that you shouldn't be doing in society, then you're going to die. It's changed. They don't really follow that line anymore. I think we've been kind of elevated into a different kind of horror. But it's that was definitely a prototype for sure.
And we're talking here on Conversation with David Allensworth. He's the creator of a new movie, Soul to Keep, and it's coming soon to you, whether it's on DVD, on the movie screen, or on demand. My name's Peter Solomon. David, horror movies don't seem to get the respect other movies get. Yet so many stars started out in horror movies, didn't they?
Certainly. Oh, absolutely. It's kind of your way in to the industry because it's an opportunity, usually, that if you're not a star yet, that you can get into a movie that has almost as much visibility as what you call the mainstream films. You know, horror as a whole is the largest movie-going audience, bar none. The largest. There are so many horrors that fill that up, but we tend to think, wow, they don't get a lot of respect. But nowadays, if you look at the box office, you see Get Out, you know, you see A Quiet Place, these movies killing in the box office. And Saw and, you know, these franchises, Paranormal Activity, Blair Witch Project, and they're making hundreds of millions of dollars. So I think horror has gained the respect. I think that we can say that now, that the old stereotype of horror having this kind of like, well, that's kind of a stepbrother of good filmmaking. It's not. And even directors, great directors, Sam Raimi is a great example, or James Wan. These guys started out and they continue to make some horror, but they move on to bigger things. So, or Tobe Hooper, you know, who did Poltergeist. So, you know, it's an interesting conception that horror movies kind of have that, like, also ran kind of feel to it. But, you know, in reality, they don't.
And it's true, I think, because I hadn't really thought of it. They keep remaking horror movies. I mean, there's a new remake coming of Pet Sematary. Mm. There's a remake of Child's Play, mm. Poltergeist. Mm. So many of them. Yeah. It really
remakes. Yeah, remakes is for any genre. The studios like to play the game of safety, and so you'll see a remake for several different movies. And in horror, particularly, it's easy to see that they're going to make money. So doing a remake of those films seems to be the way to go. They say, "Well, look, that's a recognizable brand." People love the first one, and we're going to try to improve upon that. You can't. That's a mistake, though. You know, if you have a classic, like something that just really is amazing, you try to do a remake. Every time a classic is remade, it's never that good because you can't live up to the classic. So you got to pick a remake of one that was pretty good, that did pretty well, but had some like areas to improve upon, like Pet Sematary. Like Pet Sematary is a good movie, but it had some kind of schlocky stuff in it, and so I think hopefully they've improved upon it. I haven't watched it yet, but hopefully they've improved upon it.
You hoping for a sequel or a remake to Soul to Keep?
Oh yeah, I've got an entire universe built on the idea that this is just the beginning of a onslaught of demons who are making their way to Earth to usher in that Armageddon, right? And Beelzebub is one of the seven princes of hell. I think you've heard of Lucifer, and you've heard of Leviathan and Asmodeus. And these are names that are in our culture that I like to bring to the screen. And as they come in and tell their stories, there will be an opposing force from the God side, right? The angels, the pods of angels that are already here waiting for this moment to happen. So I do see not just the universe, not just directly off of the movie that I've made where it's Beelzebub and what happens to those characters and, you know, in Beelzebub's world of raising a legion of demons. But beyond that, we're talking about other demons also making their way. And that really excites me to tell that story.
I remember once seeing a movie called Black Christmas. Its tagline was Christmas was coming early this year and it's murder. Murder stalks a sorority house. And it was kind of silly. And I remember people talking to the screen, to the heroine, don't go in the basement. Don't go in the basement. Bad things happen in the basement.
Yeah, that's true. There's a lot. I mean, that's a trope for horror films to not go in the basement or the barn or, you know, somewhere where it's, you know, scary. And a lot of those films, especially the one you mentioned, or like these sorority ones, those are called B-horrors, right? Those are the ones that are they're kind of tongue-in-cheek. They're done for some slashes, some slashing, some showing some TNA, and they sell for that market. Those are the ones that you, as you've described before, you know, go straight to cable, or you know, in the days of past, straight to the Blockbuster back wall, right? That's a different level of horror where there's a lot of those and a lot of knockoffs, and they just churn them out. I've been to some horror conventions recently where there are companies selling their DVDs of movies you've never heard of, but they kind of sort of sound like a movie you've heard of, but that's not that movie, right? And, you know, some kind of Dracula's blood, you know, like, well, I didn't see that movie, but it might sound good. And, of course, it's just a really poorly made movie, or just really low budget, and they just churn them out. That's that kind of movie.
You think horror movies will ever be respectable enough to win an Academy Award, or at least be nominated?
Yes. Yes, very much so. I mean, A Quiet Place got very close this last year. Get Out was, and it won. It won for writing. So that's a huge step in the right direction. Exorcist, of course, my favorite, was also a major film. I think that there are really talented directors and that are drawing people to the genre, and I do see a future where horror films, you know, there'll be a horror film that will win an Academy Award for Best Picture.
And the other thing I think maybe that impacts on horror movies is you can turn on the evening news and see something more horrible or as horrible as anything you can see in a movie theater. What do you think about
Certainly.
That?
That's real life, and it's almost the same draw of why we go see horror movies, is that when you see that on the news, and hopefully it's not your own life, but in the news in Philly, you know, you see something, a murder on the street somewhere, at a restaurant or wherever, you hopefully, it's not your neighborhood, and you get to, I hate to say it, but it's a catharsis that it wasn't your world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same animal that exists for why we go see horror movies. So, yes, but it is more terrifying because it's real.
And if we want to get more information about Soul to Keep, what do you want us to do?
You can find us all over social media. Just, you know, find our tag of social Soul to Keep Movie. But also we have our website at soultokeepmovie.com. And then you can follow us there. Please follow us to keep up to date of when things are happening. But we are going digital and on demand. If you go to your TV and click on demand, April 2nd, that's when you'll find us. Soul to Keep.
And I'd like to say thank you to David Allensworth for Soul to Keep and for continuing to educate us about horror movies. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And you've been listening to Conversation here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. It's going to be a nice WIP day out there. Take us with you no matter where you go. If you can't, stay tuned for WIP Sunday. Thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer, and Todman Solomon, my wife and associate producer. Nothing left to say, but see you soon. Good morning, and the conversation continues here on 94 WIP, All Sports Radio, as we ease on into WIP Sunday. It's going to be a sunny WIP Sunday here in the Delaware Valley. My name's Peter Solomon. No matter where you go, take 94 WIP with you. Always good conversation. And when we come back in just a bit, we're going to take a look at the calendar. April Fool's Day, April 1st, is right around the corner. What are you going to do? Somebody going to play an April Fool's joke on you? Are you going to play an April Fool's joke on somebody? Because that's what we're going to be talking about with our expert on all things mental health, Dr. John Huber from Mainstream Mental Health. We're going to talk about April Fool's jokes. What are they really about? All this and more when we come up here on 94 WIP, the WIP time, 7:02. And we're back. Mental health, it can be fragile in some of us. It can be quite good in some of the others. What is it for you? And is your mental health going to be tested with April Fool's Day? Well, we're going to ask that of Dr. John Huber, our expert on all things mental health. Good morning, Dr. Huber.
Good morning, Peter. How are you today?
I'm fine. I hate April Fool's Day. When I was a kid, my parents used to try and get me all the time, and usually they worked, and I never felt so stupid in my life. What do you think of April Fool's Day?
Well, you know, it's an interesting time of year, and it can be a very fun time of year as long as you don't take things too serious. You know, a lot of people like to play practical jokes. I mean, even corporations. IHOP last year said they were changing themselves from pancakes to hamburgers, and they were going to call themselves IVOP. And people were buying it for a while, and they were like, no, it's a joke. It's April Fool's, you know. So it can be a very fun thing. If you are somebody who doesn't take things well, it could be a very stressful time of year, especially if you become the target of some of these situations. And just something to think about as you go through your April 1st day here in a few weeks. Actually, a week from tomorrow.
That's right. Do you have any sense of the mental health of someone who perpetrates an April Fool's joke? I mean, are they not nice people?
Well, you know, I'm one of those guys who has always liked to do those kind of tricks. So, and I like to think I'm a nice person, but I always tended to do different types of jokes. Like I would get a local zoo, for example, and call a friend of mine's office and call his secretary and leave a message that Mr. Fox needed him to return his call today and put that phone number down. And, you know, make him take time out of his day to call the public zoo or local zoo. And the zoos are really smart. They know people do this. So you call that number, you call their main number on April Fool's Day, and 90% of them that I've called feed you right into a donation service. So, hey, you know, support our local zoo. And here's a place to give a donation to help keep the animals available and healthy for people to come and explore and discover. You know, and so, you know, I think that's kind of a healthy endeavor, but it also kind of wakes people up to, you know, I'm a firm believer that, you know, we need to find something to laugh about every single day. Laughter is such a benefit for us psychologically and physically that, anything to make us smile and giggle and laugh is beneficial to us.
Does the research support that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we see that if you're stressed out, if you laugh, even if you fake laugh, it lowers your stress levels. It lowers your blood pressure, lowers your cortical steroid levels in your bloodstream. And it actually increases a hormone called Clotho, which increases the elasticity of your vascular system and reduces your likelihood of having a stroke or an aneurysm because it makes the blood vessels much more elastic and able to stretch and resist that type of stuff.
But what about those April Fool's jokes that can be considered mean? There's one I read about recently where you take an Oreo cookie, take out the cream, and fill the Oreo cookie with toothpaste.
Yeah, that I think, I personally don't think people should joke with food. I think there are too many people in this world who have a hard time finding or getting food for us to be joking with it. That's just my personal bias. But I think part of the reason why, because it is very hateful and it hurts. You know, it hurts people. You know, taking a bite of toothpaste, the toothpaste itself, you know, you're going to spit it out. It's not that big a deal, but man, you have definitely set somebody off when they're expecting that nice creamy filling and filled it full of toothpaste. I think it can be very hurtful. And you get somebody who is young, or naive, maybe a little developmentally delayed, and not only could it be hurtful, it could be harmful when they start swallowing that kind of amount of toothpaste. The fluoride in it is not healthy for us. Can upset your stomach, cause nausea, as well as being a toxin. It's actually fluoride is used in a gaseous form called fluoramine to clean our water and kill all the bacteria and stuff in it. It's not necessarily completely 100% safe.
And certainly, if it can kill bacteria, it can kill you if you're not careful.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What do you say, though, to someone who's had an April Fool's joke played upon them and they're not happy?
Well, you know, one of the easy things you can do is sit down and have them explain the joke. You hear their story, hear their side of the situation. And I don't tell you, you have to believe all their frustration and that somebody's intentionally trying to hurt them, but it's definitely affirming for that individual if you listen and reflect back and tell them their story back to them in your own words. A lot of times just being heard is all an individual needs, and they get that off their chest and they'll feel much better and be able to deal with it. Assuming, however, that, you know, they haven't, for example, ingested a tablespoon of toothpaste or, you know, what the other big one was, injecting your donuts with mayonnaise and acting like, you know, that you got them, you know, good donuts. And, you know, to me, again, that's messing with somebody's food, and that's not, in my opinion, a healthy thing to do.
Well, maybe the best thing to say about April Fool's jokes is a joke's only a joke when two people are laughing. If it's only
exactly.
One person, it's not a joke.
And that's a pretty good judge, that right there. If only one person is laughing, it's not a joke. And, you know, you need to step back and reevaluate and maybe make some apologies at that point.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, Dr. Huber, is an astounding fact that I recently stumbled across. 42% of Americans think that a second U.S. Civil War is likely to happen soon.
You know, that's a scary number when you think about it. And the reality of it is it only takes a minority of a population to start a civil war. I think before our actual civil war, I think there was only like 17 or 18% of our population that felt like we were going to have a civil war. But that's all it took, was that catalyst and then the trigger that we had when you know, the government went out and did something that offended and threatened a lot of people, and they stood up to defend themselves, right, wrong, or indifferent. And it doesn't take much to pull that trigger. My concern is you've got two different sides this time, not necessarily geographically separated, and one side fully believes in gun ownership, and the other side, their tenet is absolutely no gun ownership. So what's the likelihood that one side is going to stand up to the other? I think having weapons is a balance. You know, we did it with Russia with nuclear weapons. When you know that there's mutually assured destruction, you tend to respect the other person and not act on that violence. And I think we need to be careful what we ask for in this country, in any place. But we have some people with some very strong beliefs, and one of them, the right and the ability to defend themselves, not just from their neighbor, but from their government, is a solid core in a lot of Americans. And, you know, be careful what we ask for. We might get it.
But what about when we have leaders who use expressions like lock and load and take care of those people and things like that?
Oh, and instigating the violence.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that a couple of times, whether it was in Ferguson or in the Carolinas. And, you know, it's a scary thing. Our politicians should not be doing that. And, in fact, I think that those individuals should be held to a higher standard when they make those kind of statements than other people. Unfortunately, the people who count, the people who vote them in or out of office, their constituents, tend to ignore those types of things. And it's the rest of the nation that gets outraged, and they're like, oh, well, they're just using sarcasm. You don't know them like we do. And the problem is words are powerful, and we have to be careful how we move forward with them.
Words are powerful, and even if they are using sarcasm or making an offhanded joke, there are people out there who might be not be, if you'll forgive me, wrapped too tight. They'll take that word, those words, literally.
Absolutely. And that's a scary thought, because there are people like that. There are people who hey, you know, all of a sudden they have no culpability. In other words, they feel no responsibility for their actions when they feel like somebody in a place of authority has ordered them to move on it. And that's a pretty scary thing to think about, especially when 42% of our population thinks that it's going to happen.
But what does that say about us? I mean, there are implications to that number that are really scary.
Yes, and I think part of it is that we have evolved, and that evolution isn't like a genetic evolution. It's an evolution in apathy. We have begun to be a headline nation. Instead of reading the content of the story, we go off the headline, which you and I both know does not always entail the content of the chapter. It's there to get you to read the chapter. And unfortunately, a lot of people are on social media and they don't have a 24-hour news cycle. They've got a 15-minute news cycle. And everybody wants those click-throughs. So what are they doing? They're trying to sensationalize one story and make it more attractive or appealing to a certain group of people who have become kind of polarized and acting like they're in a group, you know, the groupthink mentality where you have to be the first person in that group of like-minded individuals to maintain your hierarchy, to exhibit those types of leadership roles and be important in that group. Unfortunately, with social media, people filter out anybody who disagrees with them, so they've got this instant group that they look at, whether it's through Instagram or Facebook or Snapchat, of like-minded people who all think the same way, and you start to believe that nobody else in the country believes anything different than you do, because that's your exposure to the country, and your neighborhood is that social media connection. And it's not that way, but you start acting and becoming part of that group. Whereas individually, if you were addressed or talked about these types of things in a group of people you don't know how they feel, you never would make such extreme statements and extreme movements. So I think we've got this pseudo group mentality going on, and it's problematic because, you know, think about getting together in a meeting and having people design a new product, whereas one person can sit down, an engineer, and design an amazing product. You get that group together and all of a sudden, you know, it's got 30 different options that don't need to be there because groups don't always make rational decisions. And we've created social media, and social media has created this feeling that we're always within or surrounded by a same group mentality. And I think that that's a dangerous trigger that we have to watch out for.
Absolutely. And you're listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, we're checking in on mental health with Dr. John Huber from Mainstream Mental Health. Dr. Huber, stay with me. Got to run a few commercials. We'll be back in just a bit. The WIP time, 7:17. And we're back. My guest this morning, Dr. John Huber, Mainstream Mental Health, and we're talking about the mental health of the nation and what's going on. All right, Dr. Huber, though, but do you think the conflict, the fear of another civil war, is actually a mental health issue, a political issue, or maybe an economic issue? You know, the haves versus the have-nots.
Right, and, you know, it's interesting. I think you hit on it, you know, when our leaders start instigating these types of things, and it may be a political thing. I mean, we got the last president, Barack Obama, the second term, we had very similar numbers to people believing there was going to be a civil war before the end of his term, and it never happened. So we also have to look at how they do their data collection and what group of people they're actually assessing. What are the numbers? What's the sample size? How random is it? Because people who want to be interviewed for these types of surveys tend to skew the survey sample. You know, they want their extreme thoughts to be known by the world. So depending upon how the system was randomized to collect that data, they could have automatically just skewed it to a very extreme population who they sampled. And that, in reality, doesn't reflect what's really going on in the core of our country.
Because I've heard an argument recently that suggests there's a parallel between where the country is now and where Russia was at the beginning of the Russian Revolution. A lot of have-nots wanting their share of the pie, and a system of nobles and people with money wanting to hang on to what they had.
There is a lot of contrast and similarity with that. I think we've got other things going on. We've got kind of a new entitlement mentality we haven't had before in our country. And, you know, there's always that population that feels like, I deserve. But it's always been a very small minority. And what we see is that the younger generations are coming up, and it's not a small portion of them anymore. It's a third or more of that population that is feeling this way. And it's so much so, a lot of them feel totally at odds and unable to function within this, that we have a 20% suicide attempt rate from these lower generations, the newer ones coming up. That's very scary. It's the highest we've ever seen since we collected this type of data. And the only group that even comes close is actually the baby boomer generation, which was 16%, which is, you know, under the 20% cutoff for 1 in 5. So
scary, to say the least. So what's the answer? Do you have an answer to suggest?
Well, part of the answer is helping these young people learn to develop coping mechanisms, and parents are the best way to do this. Let your little kids have altercations when they're in the sandbox. Let them work through that altercation. You know, let them discover what a bully is. And when that hits mom, dad, that's when you step up and you help them learn from the situation. You help them recover, give them coping strategies, and you start training a diligent, capable population that way, because they learn from these seemingly innocuous situations that are stressful for these kids, but they learn these coping mechanisms that they later as adults can take the same type of strategies and apply them to everyday real world adult situations that have serious consequences, versus they're upset and they're crying because somebody took their toy shovel in the sandbox.
I want to say thank you to Dr. John Huber from Main Street Mental Health. Dr. Huber, you have a website?
My website is mainstreammentalhealth.org, or you can get there with a new address, drpsycho.org, drpsycho.org.
Dr. Psycho, huh? All right. Maybe an unfortunate name for the website, for your email address.
Exactly, but it's easier to remember, and it takes you to the same Mainstream Mental Health website, which is really what's important.
And I'd like to say thank you to our own Dr. Psycho, Dr. James Huber from Mainstream Mental Health. It's always enlightening when we discuss a mental health issue with the good doctor.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. You have an amazing day.
You too. And it's been another edition of WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon, the WIP time, 7:26. More good conversation in just a bit. And we're back, and it's WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon, and now I'm pleased to welcome here for conversation a lady I'm very fond of, Diane Richardson, the curator, executive director of the Ebenezer Maxwell Mansion up there in Germantown. Maxwell Mansion, Philadelphia's only restored Victorian house. We tend to think of Philadelphia as being a colonial city, but far more of us is Victorian than colonial. Good morning, Diane Richardson.
Good morning, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine. The Ebenezer Maxwell Mansion, tell me about it, please.
Well, it is Philadelphia's only authentically restored Victorian house museum. It's sort of eclectic Gothic, built in 1859 by Ebenezer Maxwell, who was a you know, just an entrepreneur, a cloth merchant, but it represents the life of the rising middle class in the 19th century in Philadelphia. And it's the cornerstone of the Topahawken Station Historic District, which is on the National Register of Historic Places as one of America's first railroad suburbs. So it's an important museum, although not as well known as we would hope.
Well, we're working on that.
Thanks, Peter.
My pleasure. Railroad suburb, because back in the day when the Maxwell Mansion was built, that was country, wasn't it?
Indeed. It was, you know, it was incorporated as part of the city of Philadelphia, but really it was just countryside. So this whole neighborhood sort of sprang up when the what we now call the Chestnut Hill East Line came out to this area in 1837, I believe. Is that the right date, Peter?
I think so.
Okay. So it's, you know, it's a very interesting, it's a really interesting and beautiful neighborhood.
Do you find convincing people to come visit the museum an easy task, a hard task, or somewhere in the middle?
Well, you know, people are really amazed by it these days. And we did a strategic plan this summer, and as part of the strategic plan, I interviewed some people in the neighborhood. And one of the things that they said was, you know, it seems like, you know, they live in the neighborhood, but they haven't been in. So we've started a new program called Coffee for Neighbors, and it's offered on select Saturday mornings throughout the year, and you can just come in, have a cup of coffee. We provide, you know, wonderful pastries, and you can see the museum free of charge. So that's one of the things. And it's all very exciting. And we do attract, you know, as you know, a lot of people through our Victorian theater productions. And we have an upcoming one of those.
Okay, let's talk about that.
All right. Okay, it's a production of The Picture of Dorian Gray. And as you know, Peter, Dorian Gray was the only novel written by Oscar Wilde. But our creative director, Josh Hitchens, has reinvented this into a one-man performance that he will be giving starting next weekend, Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon. And, you know, he's taken the novel and turned it into this play that he can interpret himself. And many people, Josh is well known for his one-man performance of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens and also Stoker's Dracula, which was picked up by Philly Fringe. And if you see him perform, he's in up in front, but he becomes each person. He just transforms himself into each person portrayed in the story. And I printed out the first page of the script. And so I want to read you one of the opening lines, which is pretty interesting. Let's see now, where is the one I like? Okay.
Now, Diane, before you do that, yes. I got to run a few commercials.
Okay.
So we'll be back in just a bit.
Okay, will do. Thanks.
And we're back. We're here on WIP Sunday with Diane Richardson. Diane is... excuse me, the executive director of the Ebenezer Maxwell Mansion. And we're talking about the mansion and their latest production of the Victorian Theater, A Picture of Dorian Gray. Diane, many people remember the picture of Dorian Gray from the old movie with Hugh Jackman.
Yes, yes. I saw that originally also. It's a little bit of a sad tale, but it's intriguing. It, you know, sort of depicts Oscar Wilde's, I think, view on the world a little bit. And it's quite fascinating. Can I read you this opening?
Please, from the script.
Okay, so I've found this to be pretty captivating. So this is the narrator speaking at the very beginning of the play, you know, the second or third line in. In the painter's studio, Lord Henry Wooton was lying on a divan of Persian saddlebags and smoking, as usual, innumerable opium-tainted cigarettes. In the center of the room, clamped to an upright easel, stood the full-length portrait of a young man of extraordinary personal beauty. In front of the portrait sat the artist himself, Basil Hallard. As Basil looked at the portrait, a smile of pleasure passed his face. But suddenly he started up and closed his eyes, placed his fingers upon his lids, as though he sought to imprison with his brain some curious dream from which he feared he might awake. If that doesn't draw you in, I don't know what would.
Basically, if you had to describe the theme of Dorian Gray, what is it?
Well, it's the story of a painting. An artist paints a picture of a painting of an attractive man in that time, and an admirer of the painting, he's a reprobate. Does all sorts of horrible things in his life, but somehow his sins and his bad behavior are transferred to the painting. So as this young man moves through his life, hurting others and I can't remember if he maybe even killed somebody, the painting itself ages and becomes a personification of the evil of this young man. So it's quite a story.
So really, you've got themes of evil, male beauty.
Yes, exactly. Right.
Sensuality.
Yes.
Drug abuse with those opium-laced cigarettes.
The opium-laced, yes. That just, can't you just see someone lying on a divan with an opium-laced in 19th century, it's fascinating.
Well, it bespeaks, though, of the Victorian era that we don't often hear about.
That's true. Of course, we have these problems today, too, with our opioid, epidemic, but they had it back then also.
Absolutely. So, I guess it is important to remember the opium epidemic is nothing new, certainly.
Yeah, I that's true. Although you had to go to these opium dens back then, you couldn't just, get a prescription for it. So,
now, how do you and Mr. Hitchens choose a topic for a production?
Well, for this year, we had never featured any Oscar Wilde plays it's almost 12 years that we've had this theater program going. And when we sat down we usually sit down in January. So when we sat down in January of 2018, we discussed what we were going to do in 2019. And we just thought it was time to do Oscar Wilde. So the whole year is filled with Oscar Wilde theater productions. Our second one will be the last weekend in April, the first weekend in May, and it's The Importance of Being Earnest. And this will be a full production with eight actors. And then in September we're doing Salome, which is another Oscar Wilde play. It's the story of King Herod's stepdaughter asking for the head of John the Baptist on a tray. So that's a little grim also. But The Importance of Being Earnest is a fun one. And then we also are having an Oscar Wilde scholar, the premier scholar in America, Dr. Margaret Stets, will be speaking about Oscar Wilde in April. So the whole year is filled with Oscar Wilde, and he was a very important 19th century author and character that we need to talk about.
And for old books aficionados, you have something happening on the Saturday with the Saturday performance, don't you?
Yes, we do. So a friend of the mansion has first edition copies of the Oscar Wilde The Picture of Dorian Gray, and I didn't know about this, but there are actually three first edition copies. The first edition was printed in Philadelphia in the form of a magazine, and he has that. And then the second first edition, and I'm a little fuzzy on the dates, I think the first edition was in 1890, and then the second first edition was the book form printed in London in 1891, just printed in a book. And then the third first edition was an illustrated version printed, I believe, in 1910 in London. And I can't remember if that's the year Oscar Wilde died or if that was some special anniversary for they printed an illustrated edition of this book. So this gentleman will be there, and if you come to that performance, you can see these first edition copies of it. It's quite amazing, actually.
Amazing that they've lasted that long.
It is amazing. It's amazing, yes. So that's an interesting thing that's going on that evening also. So we're very excited about that.
And with Herb Hatfield in the movie version of Dorian Gray, and I remember Rita Hayworth in Salome.
Oh, was Rita Hayworth in Salome?
Yes. She
okay, Salome. So we're having now. I'm gonna forget the name of the actress that's playing Salome right now. I can't remember her name. I'll think of it in a minute. But yes, ours will be equally as captivating as that movie version.
So if people don't know the actual Oscar Wilde stories, they probably have seen the movie on The Late Show.
That's correct. That's how I first knew about the picture of Dorian Gray. I saw it, as a black and white movie, yes, on The Late Show.
Diane, these are not traditional activities, though, for a house museum, I would think. Why do you do them?
Well, you know what? We wanted to educate the public about the 19th century in Philadelphia, but we want it to be entertaining. And so part of this is just Josh Hitchens is our creative director. Part of it is his idea. But when I first started working at the mansion in 2007, we wanted to continue our murder mystery event, which had been premiered the year before by the former director. And so I hired a writer, director, to direct that first year. And, it was very popular, and over 350 people attended. So then the next year I wanted it was a woman, I can't remember her name right now. She couldn't do it the next year, so then I put out a posting on the Theater Alliance of Philadelphia for a writer-director, and I interviewed three or four people and then hired Josh Hitchens, who at the time had just graduated from the theater program at Arcadia University. And he did the murder mystery for a year or two, and then he approached myself and the board of directors and asked if he could do a one-man performance of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and it just took off from there. That was just very well received, and then he came to us and offered to do a Sherlock Holmes full play in the parlor, and those were also very popular. And our theater experience at the mansion is somewhat unique because it's site-specific theater, so the audience is seated in the room in our beautifully restored 19th century, circa 1860, Victorian parlor with its Rococo Revival documentary reproduction wallpaper and the silk draperies, lambrequins, and historic lighting. And you're seated in that room, and you're on the same level as the actors performing the play. So you're right in the midst of it, and this has proved to be it's an immersive experience, and people love it.
Makes it much realer, if you will, than sitting in a theater with a proscenium arch.
Right, that's correct. Well, and, you couldn't come up with this fabulous of scenery, even if you're a Broadway production. The scenery, the background for this is just fabulous.
And the scenery probably would cost the producer $100,000.
That's correct. I guess you could reproduce it if you had enough money. It's unique in Philadelphia that way. And I want to, if you have a minute, we do have some plans for 2020. Do you want to hear that?
Sure.
Okay, so we wanted to do some theater productions that talk about African-American history because a large percentage of residents in Philadelphia are African American. So in March of 2020, we will be doing a one-man performance of The Life of Frederick Douglass. And this will be performed by, of course, an African American actor. And We're very excited about this and think it's very timely. And then in 2021, we already have planned to do a theater production of a play called An Octoroon, which is the story of, it's a slave story set in the South, and it's a very exciting, grim, but true-to-life story about life during the slavery period in the South. So we're pretty excited about that. And our murder mystery for October of 2019 is Who Killed William Shakespeare? And so the story revolves around the Shakespeare characters. Somebody got mad at Shakespeare himself, one of his characters. So the murder mystery is unique in that you move from room to room in the mansion, where you're greeted in each room by an actor portraying a suspect. And we have special effects. It's quite a bit of fun.
Oh, absolutely. And what I love about the Maxwell Mansion is your mission to educate those who come about Victorian life in Victorian Philadelphia. It's just not show and tell. It's experiencing it all the way around.
Yes, it's an experiential experience, exactly. So, you know, and it's the only place in Philadelphia where you can, you know, walk up those herringbone brick sidewalks that were always there through the cast iron fence that has been there since 1859 for 150 plus years. Up the walkway to the front door, and when the door is open, you just step back in time to 1859, and it's a little jewel box on the inside.
And while it's been a while since I visited, shame on me.
Well, I'm getting you over there, you know, this week, I think.
All right, but shame on me. You at least used to have a nice assortment of gifts from the period as well.
Well, right now, it's interesting. Someone donated money to have us put in an extra bathroom. And so right now, the gift shop, we had to remove that stuff to fit in this bathroom. But the bathroom itself is, we got an interior designer, Christine Robinson, donated her expertise for free. And we brought down items from the attic, 19th century antiques. It's beautiful. And the wallpaper in this bathroom is a Gothic Revival wallpaper that we had remnants of in the attic from the original wallpaper in the parlor. So it's just, I'm going to include it on the tour. It's quite amazing, Peter. And then we are having a very special free and open to the public event on the third Saturday in May, our annual old-fashioned picnic. And we moved the picnic date to May because in June sometimes families are away down at the shore. And for this picnic, we have activities all around the grounds. You can try your hand at peeling an apple using an Industrial Revolution apple peeler, or a French cutting green beans, or you know, grinding coffee. We have a scavenger hunt where children can look for architectural features or other aspects on the grounds, and you get a prize if you find everything. We have ring toss, an old-fashioned game of croquet. You can dress up in a 19th century costume, and we have the ability to take your photo, and you can take the photo home. We are serving hot dogs and root beer, which was introduced in the 19th century, as well as ice cream sundaes. And ice cream was new during that time period also. They'd learned how to, the old-fashioned ice cream freezer. And we've got a new sort of activity for the picnic this year. It's a hat costume, and we want you to wear your best sort of 19th century hat, and it's a nod to the Preakness, which is that being held that day, or the Kentucky Derby. And we will be giving prizes intermittently through the afternoon for people's different various hats. So you can wear an antique hat from the period, or you can make your own hat. We think this is going to be a lot of fun. And also, our local brewery located in Germantown, the Attic Brewing Company, will be there. You can have a glass of beer.
And I'd like to say thank you to Diane Richardson, the Ebenezer Maxwell Mansion, located there at 200 West Topahakan Street, 215-438-1861.
Yes.
Easily accessible by public transportation, parking on the street so it can get a little hairy sometimes. But be that as it may, it's well worth the effort. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you so much, Peter. This was delightful.
Anytime.
Thanks.
And you've been listening to WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sonny Hill. Always interesting and provocative discussion in the living room. Your opinions, Sonny's reactions. I know I'll be listening. And finally, there's nothing left to say, but see you soon.